Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's historic Market Street. I am Jim Copeland, Senior Director of the Club, and your chair today. We also welcome the listeners of WVTF-FM in Roanoke, Virginia, one of more than 200 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners, here and on radio, to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now, for this evening's speaker. When you stop and think about introducing Joe Klein, New Yorker correspondent and best-selling author of Primary Colors and now The Running Mate, it's hard not to make a connection with President Bill Clinton and think that political life in this country is about to become a lot different after next January's presidential inauguration. We've been through a lot together these past 8 years as a country, and throughout that period we have had Joe Klein to help us sort it out. His analysis and insight are generally right on the money, and his writing style is engaging. Here's a sample from a New Yorker piece. In Washington, news is a parlor game. Newspaper stories, especially those in the elite press, come encrypted with secret messages. Sometimes the messages are very personal. The lead article in the New York Times on Friday, August 14th, 3 days before Clinton testified, was just such a story. The headline was stunning: President Ways admitting he had sexual contacts. The source of the story, it was widely assumed by other Clinton advisors, was the president's old friend and legal advisor, Mickey Cantor. Cantor's law firm strenuously denies it. The media's first impression was that this was business as usual, the beginning of a new spin cycle, that it was a controlled leak with the White House taking charge of the Lewinsky story and preparing the public so that the president's revised testimony wouldn't come as a complete shock. But there was much more to it than that. Someone close to the president was sending a message, a longtime friend of the first family said, and the message was, "Stop dawdling, Mr. President. Face the facts and tell your wife and your staff that you are about to change your story." Joe Klein joined the New Yorker in December 1996 as their Washington correspondent and works out of both New York and Washington, although he will venture afield at times, as he did during the primary campaign for governor here in California in 1998. He came to the New Yorker from Newsweek, where he was a political reporter and columnist for 4 years. It was, in fact, while writing for Newsweek and covering the 1992 presidential campaign that he developed the material for Primary Colors, his widely read novel, and a subsequent movie that starred John Travolta in the Bubba role. Of that book, novelist Eric Tarloff, a White House insider during the first Clinton administration, writes, "Primary Colors is a very good novel, one of the best political novels to appear in the latter half of the 20th century." This quote is of some interest because the White House at one time suspected Tarloff might have been the anonymous writer of Primary Colors, but in the same review, he notes that the president later said to George Stephanopoulos in Tarloff's presence, "It has to be Joe Klein. He was the only one there for all the early stuff." And that's what I like best about reading Joe Klein. He's always there for the early stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Joe Klein.
So where's the fog? Thank you, Jim. It's really an honor to be standing at this podium where so many of my heroes and a few of my not-so-heroes have stood. It's always kind of fun to take this role. Usually I'm out there with you guys taking notes, watching politicians do things and say things. And when I get up here, I like to set the rules straight, you know, very quickly, let you know that this is not a politician speaking. And I want to be specific about two things that politicians always do that I will not do. The first thing that you always hear from a politician, I understand you heard it from John Kerry earlier this week, is the following. I have only a few brief remarks, and then I'll be happy to take your questions. I once covered a mayoral campaign in New York where I watched the city controller, Harrison J. Golden, say that at every stop, and I think he took like maybe one or two questions during the entire course of the campaign. And then when they do take your questions, they just give you another speech. They don't have any kind of, part of the reason why I come out and do this sort of thing is that I actually am interested in what you have to say, and I'm going to keep an eye on that big clock up there in the back and try and keep my remarks to a half hour. If not, I'll start beating myself about the head and you'll know that I'm in some difficulty. The other thing that politicians will always tell you, always, and especially in an election with, you know, in a year like the year 2000, is that we are at a crossroads. I remember the first election I ever covered was in Peabody, Massachusetts. Walter Winchell once said, if you want to learn what politics is all about, go to Peabody, Massachusetts. It was for the city zoning board, which included canine control, and one of the politicians I remember, Frank Saracino, said, we are at a crossroads in the history of canine control in Peabody, Massachusetts. So I want to set things straight we're not at the crossroads of anything in this country right now. Things are going great. This is the year 2000 may be a nice round number, but if you look at it, every last statistic is moving in the right direction. You know, things that we never thought were going to be doing well. You know, like out of wedlock births dropping, crime rate dropping, you know, welfare rolls dropping. In places like Minnesota, where they really have done welfare reform the right way, you find marriage increasing among the very poor, and people really beginning to catch on to being part of the workforce. My favorite statistic that's going in the right direction is water usage. People are actually using less water than they were in the 1980s, mostly because of those toilets that have those kind of obnoxious toilets that, you know, flush less. And now even the inner cities, according to the New York Times a couple of days ago, are going so well that the mayors are having problems. I know that's the case in San Francisco and in Oakland. I was talking to Phil Matera today. The things are going so well that many of the residents are kind of upset about the gentrification going on. And so it becomes kind of difficult to run a presidential campaign under these circumstances. And I'd like to, and you know, when you come out from the campaign trail, which I've been on an awful lot, also the book trail, but the campaign trail, an audience expects you to give the latest inside stuff. Well, I get emails from these guys every day in their campaigns, and this came in the other day. Here is the latest from the Gore campaign. Dateline, and it says at the bottom, paid for by Gore 2000. Nashville, Dateline. Chris Lehane, Al Gore's press secretary and a longtime Maine resident, today warmly welcomed George W. Bush's decision to vacation in Maine. According to the Bush campaign, Bush will be in Kennebunkport through Wednesday, June 14th. Quote, I wholeheartedly welcome George W. Bush to the state of Maine, said Gore 2000 press secretary Chris Lehane, who grew up and went to public school in Kennebunkport. It's great that Bush is vacationing in a state that was recently ranked one of the best states to raise a child. It's just unfortunate that other Texas families can't afford to regularly vacation away from Texas, a state that ranks as one of the worst places to raise a family. Now, obviously, this is a joke. In many ways, this is a joke. This campaign, Bob Strauss, the ancient an honorable Democrat said that this is an election between a candidate no one likes and a candidate no one respects. Let me say a few things about the presidential campaign, because I really want to talk about something deeper and more lasting and I believe more important. Al Gore reminds me of this story of that I remember about Ed Koch, the mayor of New York. Koch had a stroke at one point and was raced to the hospital. And shortly after he arrived there, Andrew Stein, who was the city council president, who would take over as mayor, raced to the hospital to see how Koch was. Now, Andrew Stein wasn't the most distinguished or smart public official. And he went up to see the mayor, came back down, met the press, and said, "The mayor is just fine. The only difference I noticed was that he's speaking a little bit more slowly than usual." The mayor, Koch, of course, followed everything, and he heard these words live, dispatched his press secretary, George Arst, down to the press room and said, "The mayor just wants you to know that he always speaks a little bit more slowly than usual when he's speaking to Andrew Stein." And I kind of feel that way about Al Gore. I kind of feel that Al Gore speaks a little bit more slowly than usual when he's speaking to the American people. I kind of get the sense that he thinks that we can't quite keep up with him because he's so smart and his ideas are so complicated. This is a problem that his opponent, George W. Bush, doesn't have. He's brilliant when he talks about baseball. I would support him for baseball commissioner in a heartbeat. And his brilliance on baseball kind of makes you worry about his expertise with regard to politics, because I always get the sense when I watch him speak that he's afraid that the next sentence that comes out of his mouth is going to be a major disaster. Now, if I were to continue in this vein, it would be the kind of thing that you would expect to hear from a political journalist, right? I mean, you know, what we do is rip them up, slice and dice them and spit them back out. But that's not the way I go about doing business, and that's not what my new novel is about. And in fact, before I move on to that, let me just tell you a couple of things about both Al Gore and George W. Bush to balance off what I just said. Lord Bryce, when he came to America 100 years ago to observe the political process, he said that when there are no great issues, politics turns on personality, and that's ultimately true. But in this year of no great issues, I have to tell you that both Al Gore and George Bush have done more substantive and indeed courageous policy papers than any presidential candidates in my lifetime, and I have in my professional lifetime, and I've been doing this for 31 years now. Al Gore's position on health insurance was very substantive. His position on faith-based social programs, very substantive. Education, not quite so good. Just yesterday, he came out with what I believe will be a very important position on the future of Social Security. By the way, you have to be aware of the fact that the big crisis that we're facing in this country now economically is that we're going to pay down the debt so quickly that we're not going to know where to invest the Social Security surplus. There won't be T-bills. You just watch and see. I've heard this from people on the inside. When the government figures come out over the next couple of weeks, the surplus figures, they are going to be much higher than anybody has expected, which is what you get when you get 7% growth. As for George W. Bush, he ran one of the scummiest campaigns I have ever covered in South Carolina. And in the midst of it, one morning in Hilton Head, he was having a town meeting, which he wouldn't normally be having unless John McCain had been having town meetings all over the place, but Bush was doing it. guy stands up, and I'm going to use a word here that may not be good for our radio listeners, but I'm going to use it anyway, just so that you know what happened. Guy gets up, and he says, "What, Governor Bush, what about all these unwanted bastards who are coming into the world, and they become criminals and drug addicts, and we have to pay for them, and what are you going to do?" And he goes on and on and on like this. You know the question. You know what it's about. And you know how Republicans have answered this question over the past, and more than a few Democrats have answered this question in our recent history. George W. Bush looked at the guy and was infuriated. And he said, "First, sir, you must realize that our greatest responsibility is to love all the children." And then he went into a detailed and elaborate account of the programs that he believed would help children who were born out of wedlock and into the poorest homes, many of which, by the way, I visited in his state and are excellent. So I want you to know that we are facing a choice this year between two guys who kind of act foolish an awful lot, but they're both essentially honorable, decent men, and we should be happy about that. Now comes the paid political announcement. My new novel, The Running Mate, is about an honorable man, a Vietnam veteran named Charlie Martin, who is a United States senator. And why did I do this? Because why write about an honorable? Some of the critics haven't quite been able to understand a political novel that isn't satiric or cynical. But why do this? I'll tell you why. Because increasingly in recent years, I have had the same conversation over and over again with politicians. And it goes something like this, off the record. God, this is so terrible. I'm thinking of leaving the business. I don't want my kids to find out things I did 30 years ago. I don't want my wife to find out. I don't want to have to spend all my time making phone calls. I had a conversation, phone calls asking for money. I had a conversation like this with John McCain in 1996 at the Republican convention. And he said to me, "You know, being named in the Keating Five scandal was more difficult emotionally for me in some ways than being a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 5.5 years because my honor was called into question." Charlie Martin, the hero of The Running Mate, it owes a lot to John McCain, but he also owes a lot to Bob Kerrey, another Vietnam veteran who, as many of you know, senator from Nebraska now, formerly governor of Nebraska, and he received the Congressional Medal of Honor and lost most of a leg in Vietnam. And when he was governor of Nebraska, the press found out that he was not only dating Deborah Winger, the actress, but sleeping with her in the governor's mansion. And the press came after him in all of our righteous fury, and our righteous fury is as righteous can be. We have all the disadvantages of Puritans with none of this, you know, none of the saving grace of credulousness, of belief. And we came after Bob Kerrey and said, "Governor Kerry, we found out that you're sleeping in the governor's mansion with Deborah Winger." And he said, "What can I say? She swept me off my foot." So the question I want to ask today is, why in this incredibly prosperous moment has our political atmosphere become so poisonous? Why are the people that you see on the tube from the East Coast early on Sunday mornings screaming at each other all the time? Why do people in Washington just have these incredible battles over nothing? You look at the scandals of the last 8 years. What happened? There has not been a single illegality proven. There were some unusual pizza deliveries going on in the White House, which were kind of embarrassing. But aside from that, we have had all of this sound and fury, and it has signified something. It's created an atmosphere where the public is less and less interested in politics, and more cynical about our leaders, when many of them, not all of them, but more than a few, you had one here this week, John Kerry, are honorable, egotistical, you know, often obnoxious, often, you know, less than pure, but a lot of times courageous, the way George W. Bush was that morning in South Carolina. And what, if anything, can we do about this polluted atmosphere, and where did it come from? I did a long piece a year or so ago. That's one of the glories of The New Yorker, is that you can do this sort of thing. I tried to figure out what had happened over the last 20 years, and I won't go through it all now because I have about 10, 15 minutes left. But I will get to the bottom line on a couple of the big changes that have occurred in recent history that have caused our politics to become so polluted. Academically, you could say the political parties changed. Up until the civil rights movement in the mid-60s, Democrats were a broad coalition of urban political machines and Southerners. Republicans were liberal New Englanders and conservative Main Street Midwesterners. And then when the South went Republican, the political parties became more ideologically pure. Nelson Polsby, my pal from Berkeley, who many of you have heard and probably know, say that this was a disaster. Political scientists finally got their fondest wish, which was ideologically coherent political parties, which increased the confrontation. Another thing that happened was that after Watergate, the parties had new weapons, juridical weapons. They could use the law against their opponents, and so we began to have a series of legal extravaganzas. I once asked Gordon Wood, the great historian of the American Revolution, how are things different now from they were the way they were then? I mean, you know, there were all these stories about Jefferson's bastard children, and oh, there I go again using that word. And politics was pretty rough then. And Wood said, yeah, absolutely. Politics was very rough then. The difference now is the litigation. I'm skipping over those. I could speak a lot more at a lot greater length about those, because I want to go to two things that I think are far more important and immediate right now. One is us, those of us in the press. After Watergate, our basic attitude changed from skepticism, which is good, to cynicism, which isn't so good. I have an aphorism. Cynicism is what passes for insight among the mediocre. But cynicism is the easiest sell to an editor. You'll never, ever, ever get criticized for being rough on a politician. In fact, I can remember only once or twice when an editor said to me, aren't you being a little bit too rough on X or Y? But if you write favorably about somebody, you are immediately accused by your colleagues and suspected by your editors of being in the tank. I stand before you very proudly as someone who has been accused in print in the last year of being in the tank to George W. Bush, in the tank to Bill Bradley, in the tank to John McCain. With any luck, I will be accused of being in the tank to Al Gore before this is through. And I will welcome that, because I think that we're doing a very dangerous thing here. Not only are we making the public more cynical, as I said before, but we are driving interesting people away from the process. We're driving potential candidates away from the process. Another thing that's happened during this time, and in the running mate, this becomes very, very clear, is that politics has become, I mean, if we're living in the golden age of anything, we are living in the golden age of marketing. And marketing has taken over politics as it's taken over everything else. In the running mate, Charlie Martin, every day during his campaign, is asked by his consultants to do something outrageous, something that he finds reprehensible. And he almost always says no. Almost. A couple of times he says yes, almost ruined his life. And it's really fun for me when, especially as a novelist, when life imitates art. But about a week after the McCain dropped out of the campaign, one of his consultants sent me a note apologizing for his role in having John McCain take the position he did on the Confederate flag controversy in South Carolina. As you know, John McCain later came out and publicly apologized for it. John McCain's one of the most honorable people I know. And if he makes mistakes like that, just think of how difficult this process is for lesser people, among whom I include myself and almost everybody I know. I think that we have to become a little bit more, we in the press, and maybe we in the public too, a little bit more understanding of our politicians and understanding of the fact that we demand perfection of them 100% of the time, and when they screw up, we crucify them. I think that it's time to make the process a little bit more humane. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is the fourth cause of the polluted political atmosphere that I found when I investigated it for The New Yorker. And it's a little bit more amorphous than the others. And I'm speaking mostly to those of us in the audience who are baby boomers. But I'll speak to our parents in the audience as well. One of the interesting things I did one day as a journalist was interview Bob Michael, who was the Republican leader of the House before Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was one of the few people in the world who actually thought that the millennium came in 1994. At the end of the day, I spoke with Vin Weber, who is a former congressman from Minnesota, who was one of Newt's most thoughtful lieutenants. And I asked Michael is like this classic Peoria, Illinois congressman, has that little bar, that little purple heart bar on his lapel, was wounded severely in the Battle of the Bulge, which, as many of you know, was as bad as it got in Europe during World War II. And he came back, like many of his generation, with the intention of pushing politics to the side. I remember when I spent a lot of time in Russia in 1989 and 1990, people kept on saying to me, I wish our lives were less political. Well, their lives were entirely political up to that point because the state was making every last decision for them. Bob Michael had lived through 15 years of depression and then World War. And he wanted to slow things down, calm things down, and create the atmosphere that led to the suburbs and prosperity and all the things that those of us who marched in the 60s thought were so stupid and banal. My generation, when we came in to Washington, symbolized by Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, were very much the opposite. At the end of the day, after talking to Bob Michael about what he really wanted government to be about, I talked to Vin Weber. And I said, what happened, Vin? Because if the poisonous atmosphere has a name, it is Newt Gingrich. Newt is a reverse Clausewitzian. Remember von Clausewitz, the German military historian who said war is the extension of politics by other means? Newt believes that politics is the extension of war by other means. In fact, he has said, and I quote, "Politics is war without blood." I asked Vin what had gone wrong, and he said, "We didn't respect our elders. We didn't understand the value of stability. We wanted to rip everything up. We, my generation, are a generation of dilettantes who never knew sacrifice. And we have been playing with fire in a very prosperous and stable country." And when I think about what I'd like this election to be about this year, and what we can do for to make this better for our kids, what can we give them that we didn't have? I think about one word, service. I think about the thing that distinguished the greatest generation from the baby boom generation. Sacrifice and service. Now, of course, in a global economy, there are going to be less opportunities. I'm not a warmonger, and I don't think that all of our kids should go into the army. And in fact, I think that probably, despite what you hear and will read in the papers and watch on TV during the course of this campaign, military matters will become increasingly more peripheral. Because in a global economy, there's a basic rule. In any economy, there's a basic rule. It's not smart to kill your customers. How do we give our kids the experience of service and sacrifice? Bill Clinton had part of the answer with his national service proposal in 1992, which has been a quite good program, but I would expand it. I think that this is really important, and as I close, I'll tell you why. See, I really am keeping to my 30-minute limit. Military historian William McNeil from the University of Chicago, at the end of his life, looked back and wondered, had a basic question. Why was the period that he remembered most nostalgically, most fondly, the summer that he spent on a dusty drill field in boot camp preparing for World War II? And so he decided to write a book about the history of military drill. And he gave it a wonderful title. It was Keeping Together in Time. And what he found out was that when you took it all the way back to the African savannah, it was doing drill, dancing together, keeping together in time was one of the first things that, well, not the first thing, but one of the first things that people did together for a very basic reason. If an individual went out to kill a lion, the individual usually didn't come back. However, if a group of people got together and rehearsed and did the killing the lion dance, they were much more likely to succeed. And so, in the classic Darwinian fashion, dancers were selected for. It became one of the most basic human impulses to move together in time, to be part of something larger than yourself. It became the way children, especially male children, made the transition from childhood to citizenship. It is these sorts of ceremonies and rituals we may scoff at, but they are at the very heart of a civilization. And I would love to hear these guys, George Bush and Al Gore, speaking about this, because it goes to the very heart of the thing that Americans are most worried about right now. I have attended about 75 town meetings in the past year, all different kinds of politicians, all different kinds of situations. And in a plurality, not in a majority of the cases, the first question is always the same: Columbine. People are scared. They are worried about their kids. They are worried about the culture that we thrust in the faces of our children. And I may be a lonely voice in this case, but I think it is really important for us as a society to begin to communicate the importance of keeping together in time, of having that kind of shared experience as police officers. As there's a wonderful program called the Police Corps, which actually does use a 12-week boot camp to prepare young people to become police officers for 4 years, to become teachers in programs like Teach for America, to become social workers, to take over much of the person-to-person, people-to-people work of government. If I had a message, if I were a politician standing up here in front of you, the way so many great ones have, the message that I'd want to leave to our kids, it would be to our kids. It would be the old message of Arthur and Catherine Murray. We want you to learn how to dance. Thank you very much. And now I'll be happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Joe Klein, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker and author of the new bestseller, The Running Mate, for joining us today. Now, Joe Epstein, past president of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you very much, Senior Director Jim Copeland, for the introduction. And now, Mr. Klein, we have a great number of questions for you. I've put them in some cases in order. In other cases, they're going to be a little bit of a shotgun approach. But let's begin this with this one. I've just met you this evening, and you don't look very old to me at all. You look like quite a young man. But here's a question that says, you've apparently covered 7 presidential campaigns. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So in 2 minutes or less, no, I'm just kidding, you take as long as you want. Would you care to give us sort of an overview and a comparison of those? You can certainly highlight.
Seven?
Not all 7 if you don't care to.
I will say one very basic thing about presidential politics and not answer that question. Because all 7 campaigns and all political campaigns, especially for something as intimate as the presidency, have something in common. There's always a moment when the money that you have raised as a candidate doesn't matter and all of your consultants don't matter. When you are confronted with an immediate situation or a question and the only thing that matters is what's in your heart, what comes out of your mouth, and what the American people perceive. You remember the moment for Michael Dukakis. When he was asked about what he would do if his wife were raped and murdered, would he want the death penalty for? And he reacted like a very dead fish. For Ronald Reagan, it was, there you go again. For Bill Clinton, it's really interesting, and in some ways it is the most memorable moment of all for me, since Bill Clinton is the most astonishing politician I've ever covered. It came in the 1992 second debate, the one with the audience. And the question came from the audience. A black woman asked, do you know anyone who's unemployed? And it was very clear, there was a time, it was less happy economic time than now, and it was very clear what she had in mind to those of us who had been actually out there and covering the campaign. George H.W. Bush had no idea what she was talking about and mouthed platitudes. Ross Perot mouthed platitudes faster. I don't remember what Bill Clinton said, but I do remember what he did. He took 3 steps toward the woman. He became president of the United States because of empathetic body language. I truly believe that. The American public understood at that point what they have understood ever since about Bill Clinton, which is he is a womanizing, intermittently truthful, manipulative, overly political, master of his trade who actually cares about people. That was a correct judgment in 1992. It stands to now. And I would, as you go ahead and watch the rest of the year, look out for that moment. It's going to happen this fall as sure as I'm standing here. Because in this election, there's only one basic question. Everybody kind of knows that Al Gore can be president. But they don't like him all that much. People aren't so sure about George W. Bush. Looks kind of smug, looks like someone's son. And he will, and he's going to have a moment in one of the debates where he either liberates Poland the way Jerry Ford did in 1976 and loses the election, or he turns to Al Gore, who will be busily ripping his lungs out, and says the Reagan-esque equivalent of, there you go again. But this election is about one thing, and it's about whether people decide that George W. Bush has the stature and character to be president.
Well, when Richard Nixon lost the race for the governorship of California, he told the press, you won't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore. You're not going to have Bill Clinton to kick around anymore, and this question's asks, will you miss covering Bill Clinton? And how will your writing at The New Yorker change once the president leaves the White House?
Oh, I'll absolutely miss Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton's been very, very good to me. And I would say furthermore, I would say Bill Clinton's been very, very good to us. I think he's been a pretty good president. And I want to point out something to you about my character, Jack Stanton, who bears a certain resemblance to Bill Clinton. One thing I learned in the course of writing Primary Colors was something that I always suspected, which is the great politicians are like great steaks. You know, there's muscle and there's fat and they're marbleized. There are great strengths and there are great weaknesses. You don't get one without the other. And I would much rather have a larger-than-life president than a smaller-than-life president. I would much rather have someone like Bill Clinton than someone who married his high school sweetheart and did nothing else in life except be ambitious. I want someone who understands my sins. My idea of a great president was a guy who cheated on his wife and destroyed his marriage, drank a pitcher of martinis every night, played poker with the staff and cheated, lied to the American people about basic issues of war and peace, sicked the Internal Revenue Service on his enemies, and my grandfather voted for him 4 times, Franklin Roosevelt. I think I celebrate Bill Clinton's weaknesses. I love him for them. I feel sad for him, for the torture he's gone through and that his family's gone through. But I think that the politicians, that he's a guy who's lived through the last 30 years. And I'm a guy who's lived through the last 30 years. And anybody our age, who's lived through the last 30 years and done something that they weren't totally embarrassed by, hasn't lived through the last 30 years.
Well, Joe, you've written at least 2 that I know of major political novels. You just referred to Primary Colors and then the book that you're here tonight to talk about, The Running Mate, your new one. Now that you've accomplished these two feats, how have your personal views changed vis-a-vis the types of individuals that want the world's most important job?
They're not like you and me. Politicians are different. I mean, they are. And, you know, they are complicated, and they appall me, and I love them. One of the interesting things about the reaction to Primary Colors is that journalists were so angry about it because I violated the rules by denying my authorship. And while I adhered to the rules of anonymous authorship, which are the oldest rules there are in literary life, but the really interesting reaction was from politicians. Not all of them, but more than a few of them came up to me afterwards, and these were people who both liked Bill Clinton and didn't like Bill Clinton. But they came up to me and they said, "You really got what it felt like to be in the middle of one of these campaigns." And that's what I tried to do. That was one of the main purposes of Primary Colors. There hadn't been a novel, I thought, that had caught the insanity, the velocity, the intensity of modern politics. We are asking, as I said before, we're asking these people to do a very, very difficult thing. And it's kind of gratifying to me when a politician will come up to me and say, "You understand how hard it is." It's also kind of hilarious when you get the opposite from a politician. You remember, well, you're Californians. You remember Bob Dornan, the lunatic from Orange County. Remember he was running for president in 1996, and I bumped into him on an escalator in Des Moines. He was at that point, I think, owing points in the polls. And he said to me, "Joe," he said, "you know, they really can't stand us. They're really angry at us. They don't like politicians." And I said, "Bob, what have you been telling them about politicians for the last 20 years? Why should they like you? I mean, I don't like you." I think that it's, you know, the biggest thing that I've learned is that the reason why I do this, even now, even after I've had these successes, the reason why I go out and ride the buses and get my wife really angry because I'm not at home is because there are moments like the one with George W. Bush and Hilton Head. I don't do this to watch them fall on their faces. I do this because they can inspire me.
You have been referred to as anonymous, as you've admitted. Before, it was known, of course, that Eric Tarloff or George Stephanopoulos was not the author of Primary Colors. However, you are only the second most famous anonymous. This question simply says, who is or was Deep Throat?
Did anybody see the movie Dick? Two teenage girls in that movie are Deep Throat. I don't know. I mean, you know, at one point I was in the Sheridan Wayfarer in New Hampshire during the New Hampshire primary having breakfast with Bob Woodward, and we walk out into the hallway and a woman comes up to us with a brownie and says, "Anonymous and Deep Throat," and takes a picture. But, you know, I'm not even the most famous anonymous novelist. The novel Democracy by Henry Adams wasn't written by Henry Adams, and that is one of the great American political novels. It was written by Anonymous, and he wasn't exposed until 3 years after he died. And I would venture to say that an even more famous Anonymous is whomever wrote the book of Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus.
Well, this questioner was listening very carefully to your talk, and they would like you to elaborate on the debt matter that you mentioned. They want to know how it's possible that we will pay off a $4 trillion debt. And if we do accomplish that, do we need to be spending more on social programs? And they want to know if social programs, in your opinion, might be underfunded.
Wow, substance. Cool. I like substance. I think that we're going to have, you know, I think that the debt estimate is going to diminish by, the surplus estimate is going to increase by $1 trillion in this next report. That means that we will have another trillion dollars more than we thought we were going to have over the next 10 years, which makes it somewhere around 3 or 4, which brings us pretty close to paying it off. And then after that, you're going to have a period of time where more is coming into Social Security than is going out. And the question is, where do you put it? And I think that we're going to have to start rethinking a lot of our social programs. I think Bill Clinton started this. But most of the social programs that we have were built for the industrial age. The paradigm of the industrial age was the assembly line and the factory with its top-down kind of bureaucratic model. The paradigm, here I am in San Francisco, I don't need to be telling you guys this. The paradigm for the information age is the computer network, which is more diffuse and interactive. And I think that programs like health insurance, and believe me, I believe that we need national health insurance. Don't clap too soon, because I want to say the rest of this. I think we need it in an economy that is going to be as volatile as the information age economy is. We need it just as a matter of pure economic efficiency so that people won't stay in jobs just to keep their health insurance. But you can't do it the way Hillary wanted to do it. You can't lay it on employers, because they're in a global economy too, and they have to compete against other employers and other countries that don't have the responsibility of providing for their employees' health insurance. And you can't do it in the old-fashioned Western European top-down single-payer mode. I think that what Bill Bradley came, the reason why people said I was in the tank to Bill Bradley was that I thought that his plan, which was actually a further development of a plan that came out of the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank, is the way to go. A very progressive and refundable at the bottom level voucherized system where you give people a choice. I think that in each area of our social policy as we move ahead, and that includes schools, we are going to have to acknowledge the fact that in an information age, people have a lot more information, and they are going to demand choices. And also, asking them to make choices makes them better citizens. I was telling this story to Judson last night as we drove in from the airport. I was one of the first reporters to cover the school choice experiment in East Harlem. They went from the worst schools in the city to right in the middle, which was a tremendous achievement for an area that was known as Spanish Harlem. They did it by creating a market. You know, the money went with the kids, and if no kids wanted to go to a school, the school closed. And what you had there, what I learned by watching that is this. There is a classic situation, and it happens in almost every social policy area that you can look at. 10 to 15% of the parents were already forcing their way into the schools that they wanted their kids to go to. Another 10 or 15% of the parents just couldn't give a damn, and they just sent their kids to the closest school to their home no matter what. The 70 to 75% in the middle, when they were told, well, now it's up to you where you send your kid, actually made a good faith effort to try and find the best program for their kids. And in the process of doing that, became better citizens, became better, more involved citizens, and more aware citizens. My problem with liberals is that they tend to fix on the 10 to 15% who just don't give a damn. What are we going to do about them? They're going to fall farther and farther behind and forget about the tremendous value that comes with empowering that 70%. I think that I'm in favor of something that most of Washington hates when it comes to social policy. I'm in favor of voucherizing almost everything, which Democrats hate because they are in the pocket to the public employees unions, and I am in favor of spending a lot more money on things like education and health and the other and poverty. You get 7 or 8 votes for that in the House of Representatives.
Well, switching gears quickly back to President Clinton, co-authors Joe Connison and Gene Lyons appeared at the Commonwealth Club this year on this very podium. In their book, Hunting of the President, they claim that there was a right-wing conspiracy to discredit, by any means, President Clinton and Hillary. Could you give us your views, please, on the thesis of this book and on the book itself?
Well, I haven't read the book, so I can't give you a judgment on the book, but I'll give you a judgment on the thesis. I don't know that there is an organized conspiracy on the right to take down President Clinton, but I will say this. There has been the most unfair and cruel and crude and destructive campaign against him and his wife that I have ever witnessed in politics. I have been astonished by it. And I've been astonished by the press's role in it. I have throughout, you could look it up, throughout scorned all of these scandals. I said Whitewater was nothing when it was nothing. I said the travel office was their business, that you could hire and fire whoever you damn well please to run your travel office. I thought the FBI files was just a glitch and just a silly bureaucratic mistake, which it turned out to be. There were no fingerprints. They were looking for Hillary's fingerprints on the files. They weren't there. And as for Lewinsky, I said the week that that happened, I wrote it in the New Yorker, and this goes for the whole period. And I lay this at the doorstep not only of those right-wing fanatics who have cost so many good people, so many friends of mine in the government, so much money. I have a friend who, I won't tell you who he is, but who spent all of the savings that he had gotten together for his kids' college education, he had to spend it on litigation because of stupid right-wing kook lawsuits. And I wrote in the New Yorker that this was a period that will be remembered more for the ferocity of its prosecutions than for the severity of its crimes, and such periods are never remembered fondly.
Well,
there's a boo back there.
Mr. Klein, unfortunately, we've reached that point in the program where there's time for just one last question, and I'm going to try to sneak in two of them, if I could.
Yeah.
Here's a question about Hillary Clinton. Is she a carpetbagger in the traditional sense? And if she wins, will she represent New Yorkers well, or is she looking for something bigger? And if you have time, the last question really is Danny Williams Clinton's son, or is it just a hoax?
It's a hoax. Come on, please. It's nonsense. It's absurd. It's another one of the scandals that doesn't even bear. I mean, do you know that Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell were distributing videotapes that claimed that Clinton was a murderer? This is outrageous. By the way, can I give you, just to answer this question, let me give you one of the smartest theories I've heard about why Clinton is so hated. It comes from Stephen Skowronek, who is a professor of history at Yale, and he places Clinton in something called the third-way presidency. A third-way president is one who takes the agenda of the opposing party and sands down the rough edges and then implements it. And in the process, he not only earns the enmity of his own party, but also the enmity of the opposing party. other third-way presidents, Richard Nixon, who was far more liberal than most people give him credit for. Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt hated Woodrow Wilson for stealing his progressive agenda and implementing it. I think that that's part of why people are so angry at Bill Clinton. And the other is that he is this classic scapegoat. In the ancient world, before we Jews socialized the concept of scapegoatism and made it safe for children and put it all on goats, a scapegoat was actually guilty of the crime that he was charged with. There's a professor here at Berkeley who has done most of the research on this. Bill Clinton is guilty of the three great crimes of my generation. Sex we don't need to talk about. But the other two are really interesting, and I think they explain why my colleagues were so furious during the Lewinsky year. The second one is the triumph of marketing over substance. The fact that he would poll any old thing. He had Dick Morris poll where he should go on vacation. And I think that all of us who are in journalism understand that there's a reason why Tom Brokaw delivers the news standing up as opposed to sitting down comfortably the way he used to, that we have all been victims of the triumph of marketing over substance. And the third thing that Bill Clinton is guilty of is that he skated his responsibility, that he's a classic fudger, and we all, as I said to you before, skated our responsibilities. As for Hillary Clinton, a carpetbagger, in the traditional sense, is she an overweight northerner who goes south carrying a bag with a... No. I think that in a country where professional wrestlers can run for office and become credible public servants, first ladies can as well. I worry about her. I worry about her. I think that in a way it would have been a lot better for her to take a couple of years and chill out and think about all of her options. I think she may be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm not sure yet how good a politician or how good a public servant she's going to be. She certainly isn't on my page on the substance issues that I was talking about before. She wants to spend the money, but boy, is she singing the public employees union's tune. And I think that until we liberate the poor and liberate our children from the grip of the current bureaucratic system, we're not going to be totally prepared to enter this new age. So I'm hopeful. I've had a lot of great conversations, really smart conversations with her over the years. I think she's a real decent human being. I have no idea what's going on in that marriage. I could tell you a fair amount about Jack and Susan Stanton, but that was just my educated guess. I don't know anything more about the Clintons than you guys do. But I think that she's going to have that moment, too, between now and November, and you should watch for that one as well. There's going to come a time when she's going to have to respond in real time to a tough question, and we'll see who she is. I don't think we know who she is yet. We know an awful lot about Bill, though. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Jill Klein, Washington correspondent of The New Yorker and author of The Running Mate, for joining us today. And we also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on radio, and invite you to join us again soon. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.